From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how an unemployed 25-year-old GOP candidate beat a crowded field and gets a crack at the state house.
We were optimistic, but to actually see that I won, it's a little bit shocking to actually see that.
And the retired Marine Lieutenant General who'll run for Congress from the 1st District.
I'm a negotiator.
The music therapist who sets her patients' heartbeats to music.
I can record anybody's heartbeat, and sometimes we get the entire family's heartbeat.
And Michigan's long history with the Coney dog.
It is a very simple working man's food. Nobody was there to pop a bottle of champagne or cut a ribbon when the first one was made.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of Michigan's marquee races this election year is the one to replace retiring Republican Representative Dan Benyshek in the 1st Congressional District. The 1st covers the entire Upper Peninsula and much of the Northern Lower Peninsula. State Senator Tom Casperson and former State Senator Jason Allen were hoping to make the November ballot. So was a retired 3-star Marine Lieutenant General named Jack Bergman.
This election, you have a choice. Vote for another career politician and get more of the same, or vote for me, a straight-talking Marine Corps general. I'll get the job done.
Well, that message clearly hit home with voters because Jack Bergman won the 1st Congressional District Republican primary, and he is with us now. General, welcome to Stateside.
Great to be with you.
Why do you think you and your message spoke strongly to people in the 1st Congressional District over State Senator Casperson and former Senator Allen?
I believe that the message spoke to the people of the 1st District, pure and simple, because they have been looking and observing and experiencing the performance of their politically elected officials, and they weren't satisfied. So my message basically differed and appealed to them because I guess they looked at me and said, I think this guy might be what you see is what you get. Direct, to the point, and is not gonna try to shade anything just to serve himself.
Tell us, if you would, a little, General, about your service in the U.S. Marine Corps. Was it about 40 years?
Just about 40 years. It's, you know, everything we own now is a hybrid, right? Then I had a hybrid career in the Marine Corps, 6 and a half years active duty on the front end, flew helicopters in Vietnam, came back, was a flight instructor for a few years, got a master's degree while on active duty, and decided to seek my fame and fortune in the business world. But I stayed in the reserves. Fast forward to the late 1990s, and the Marine Corps decided I should have a star and become a brigadier general. Well, one star led to 2 stars, led to 3 stars. 9/11 got in there in the middle, and it was an unprecedented call-up of Guard and reservists for a long period of time. So my last 6 years of active duty, or last 6 years of duty in the Marine Corps, were actually back on active duty, living and working in Washington, D.C. for the first two of them. And then still working in D.C., but living in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is the headquarters of the Marine Corps Reserve.
You're going to face Democrat Lon Johnson in the November election. Should you win and go to Congress, what will be your priorities?
I will work starting right now on the campaign trail, which I already started 6 months ago, figuring out what the priorities of the voters of the 1st District are. And not everything can be a number one priority. So we prioritize together. And then my job in Washington, D.C. is to figure out the how to get those priorities into place, get them in, get them heard, get legislation done, get money approved. Example, SULOCs. SULOCs have been approved. SULOCs has been put on hold from the funding standpoint. It's way overdue. Now, when you combine the economic necessity for the lock with the national security, which is fairly new, based upon the security situation in the world, we need to get the SULOC funded and get the project going because it's a national need now, just not just a state of Michigan need. So I'm a uniter, not a divider. So the job of getting people, I don't care what party you're from, to work together to tackle tough issues that really are not about you. They're about the good of the country, the good of your state. That's what I do.
I want to build on that and to that point, General. As we all know, Congress certainly has been hindered by polarized partisanship. And on the right, many incumbents have taken heat because they compromised with Democrats to get legislation passed. Talk to us some more about your view on reaching compromises in politics, in Congress.
Well, I think different words mean different things to different people. Boy, I certainly learned that early on the campaign trail, where I might have used a word that meant something to me, but it meant something different to the people in the audience. And I got called on it a couple of times. What do you mean by that? The point is, compromise is one of those words. I would suggest to you what I am is I'm a negotiator. You come into a room with me with your viewpoint, and I have my viewpoint. I'm going to negotiate with you till we finally get to a position where, number one, we didn't compromise our standards, we didn't compromise our principles, but we found a better way for the country to achieve what it needs to achieve. So I'm a negotiator.
I have to ask you, General Bergman, do you support Donald Trump for president?
Well, I certainly don't support Hillary. There's a lot of media fueling the fire here, so I'm been spending a whole lot of time here just trying to win my own primary election. I'll start taking a serious look at some of the other stuff here very shortly. But bottom line is, I cannot support the Democratic nominee because there's no unknowns, and we know what we're going to get.
But I do think there are a lot of voters and a lot of people within the Republican Party, you know, wrestling with this question of supporting Donald Trump, especially considering his comments about the parents of the Muslim American Army captain killed in Iraq. And that certainly is something that is a pressing issue for all Republicans. So I do think it's a fair question whether you feel that you support Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think, and here's, but let me. He is the Republican nominee the last time I checked. So you have a choice. You have a choice. As a pilot, I choose not to make my choices too early because the winds may change. They may change the runway on me or something might happen. So I'm going to watch what's happening here over the next few weeks.
Jack Bergman is a retired lieutenant general with the United States Marine Corps. He won the first congressional Republican primary, and so he'll face Democrat Lon Johnson in November. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure and my honor. Thank you so much.
Technology and creativity, they're not mutually exclusive. They go hand in hand. That's the message of Intermittent, the group holding a conference this Friday and Saturday in Ann Arbor, all about exploring ways that successful business efforts contain a healthy mix of creativity and technology. Trevor Mays is with Intermittent. Trevor, is it fair to say it often seems when we talk about creativity and technology that we tend to make it either or?
Yeah, I would tend to say that those two groups polarize themselves and see themselves as one or the other. And in some places, those communities can even be at odds with one another. We thought that that doesn't have to be the way. And what really drove that was the discovery that so many of the people who work in our tech groups and the community at large are very dialed into each other's work. There's people who work at our startups who have passion projects. They're in bands. They're artists. They spend their weekends teaching kids how to DJ and stuff like that. And we got our heads together, this group of founders who put together Intermittent. And what we came to know is that this is something that's not really being talked about a lot. It's something that we really feel it should be showcased and should demonstrate how we're getting healthier communities and economies and technology companies as a result.
What does that balanced blend look like of creativity and technology?
It's always at odds with one another. There's a certain amount of work that has to be put in to sustain yourself. We think that, you know, there doesn't have to be this starving artist mentality, that you can sustain your livelihood and have a family and have a prosperous life while spending your evenings and weekends working on these projects and driving them to fruition.
And in the conference, you want to, and this is the first of what you hope will be many conferences, you want to kind of dig into this balancing act and how it works. Who is the conference aimed at?
A wide variety of people, ranging from those who are, you know, working professionals or creative professionals, trying to understand a wider scope of what's out there and what's available. We think that there is an ideal person who's at this conference who's trying to learn how they can do both of these things better, how they can push the agenda forward, how they can really drive creative innovation in their workplace, but also have these passion projects and these interests and these things that are thriving outside of their workplace and how those prop each other up.
Who would you say would be some of the big stories or the big companies that you want to focus on and you want to really shine light on through this conference?
Yeah, some of the people who are speaking at this conference are from Icon Interactive. They're a company here in Ann Arbor who does design work from everyone ranging from Bob Dylan to Subaru and everything in between. Atomic Object, who's based in Ann Arbor and Grand Rapids, and they develop apps for things like Art Prize, which is an art contest that happens in Grand Rapids every year. We have Duo Security, and that's a security company here in town, and it doesn't sound that appealing. It's just like it's a security company, but they're doing some amazing stuff. They're actually going to send the first authentication of internet security in outer space next week. We have a design team at Duo, that's where I work, and they're outputting movies and creative assets and designing things that make it simple to use. It doesn't have to be this obscure, crazy world.
Like you're saying, a nice blend of technology with creativity. And what does that mean for the whole state of Michigan? When you think about what you're doing with Intermittent and the fact that this conference is happening on Friday and Saturday, what can that mean beyond the 2 days and looking out to the state?
We think that people who are attending the conference are going to be able to take ideas back to their own communities and implement them. By removing that adversity between the creative community and the tech community, you can really create a prosperous, tight-knit group of people, and that makes more well-rounded individuals, people who are bringing their creative projects to life in their own communities. And because of that, they aren't getting burnt out in their day-to-day work. They're growing, they're thriving, they're bringing with them new perspectives and really helping forge what we believe to be like a new powerful tech economy. It's not cube farms and phone centers and stuff like that anymore, or just people staring at lines of code all day. By having a more vibrant and prosperous work life, people have the extra bandwidth and mileage outside of their day-to-day to drive forward these new creative projects and really help foster a stronger local community.
Can people still go to the conference?
Yep, our conference ticket registration is open till the end of this week, and we'd love to see some more people attend. We've got quite a group of attendees already registered, and they can use the Friend of Intermittent 16 discount code for 25% off their tickets.
Okay, and it's in Ann Arbor, and it is going to be this Friday and Saturday. And you can learn more by going to the website intermittent.org. That's intermittent.org. And Trevor Mays is with Intermittent. Trevor, thank you so much for sharing your work with us and your vision of a nice blend of creativity and technology.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There was a surprising result in the primary election in West Michigan's 72nd district to replace term-limited Republican State Representative Ken Yonker. The GOP ticket was crowded, five candidates, and perhaps most surprised at the outcome was the winner. Stephen Johnson of Wayland got a solid win, including over the candidate backed by the DeVos family. Stephen Johnson is 25 years old. He's unemployed. And now he could be headed to Lansing to represent the people of Kentwood and Gaines Township in Kent County and the northeast corner of Allegan County. Stephen Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
How did you feel, Stephen, when you realized that you got 30% of the vote, that you had beaten four other candidates?
You know, it felt great. It really did. It showed that the people do have a voice and that the special interests, they can spend however much money they want. But at the end of the day, it's up to the people to decide. And that just felt really good.
Did you really expect to win?
We were pretty confident. Maybe not confident, but cautiously optimistic. We knew that we knocked way more doors than anyone else. We were the hardest working people. We didn't have the money, but we had the right message and the right work ethic. So we were optimistic, but to actually see that I won, it's a little bit shocking to actually see that.
Why do you think, Stephen, that you resonated with the Republican voters in the 72nd?
I think the biggest issue with voters is they're sick and tired of politicians telling them one thing, and then they get elected and they turn their back. And so they're looking for someone, you know, how can they know to trust someone? And my message was, I'm a constitutional conservative. My values are rooted in the Constitution and in my Christian faith. Anyone can say whatever they want, but if they're not rooted in something, they're going to fold when they go to Lansing. The temptations are too high. So I think they like that I have my principles rooted in something, like in the Constitution, in my Christian faith. And I think that just really resonated.
Let's talk a little about you. I know you'd interned for former State Representative Cindy Gamright, and then you moved to Alaska?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was interning there, and when that whole thing happened, I was shocked and didn't kind of know what to do. And I figured, well, why not go to Alaska? So I went up there and started a handyman business with a friend of mine, who he actually still has it going today. And it was a great experience.
And what brought you back to Michigan?
I felt God calling me back to politics. I was in Alaska for a few months and came back down here and just didn't really know where in politics. And I saw it was an open seat. And so I said, you know what? I'll go for it. And I went all in.
And should you win in November, what are your priorities as you look forward to going to Lansing?
Number one, pro-life issues. We have a Republican majority, but they haven't made any gains on pro-life issues. Fundamental role of government is to safeguard our right to life. We need to pass some more pro-life legislation. And in addition to that, the size of government has grown too big. Every year, the budgets get bigger. It's time to reduce spending, reduce taxes, let people keep more of their hard-earned money. Let's get government back to doing its fundamental role instead of doing these programs that they shouldn't be involved in.
You have stated that you clearly admire West Michigan Congressman Justin Amash. I'm wondering, who in the state legislature do you see as potential role models or potential mentors?
So in the Senate, Pat Kolbeck, definitely a strong leader. He's taken a lot of criticism for sticking up for his beliefs, and yet he's still held strong. So he would be my role model in the Senate. And then in the U.S. House, Gary Glenn, great guy. Talked to him several times. Very similar to Pat Kolbeck, just strong values, strong principles. Those would be two men that I would really, really hope to help guide me.
Stephen Johnson is the winner of the Republican primary for state representative from West Michigan's 72nd District. He'll face Democrat Steve Shoemaker in the November election. Stephen, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Recently, MLive asked readers, what is your pick for a state food of Michigan? Clawing its way to the top of the poll over pasties and Boston coolers and Superman ice cream was the Coney Island hot dog. That poll got us wondering, just how did the Coney dog become such a key part of Michigan's food scene, especially in the Detroit area? And how'd they get that name? Joe Grimm is editor-in-residence at Michigan State University. He co-authored Coney Detroit. Joe, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Cynthia, and talking about this subject.
Mm-mm. And as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at this huge full-page picture in Our Detroit of two incredibly gorgeous Coney dogs, life-size nearly. Is there one true version, real version of the Coney Island hot dog?
Yes, there is. And it's a great question because there are varieties of Coneys, but there is one true version of the Detroit Coney Island hot dog.
And what is it?
I would be happy to describe it. Forgive me if I drool.
Go ahead.
Well, let's start with the base. That's got to be a steamed bun, and those buns are baked with the sponge dough method so that they'll stand up to being in the steamer. On top of that bun, we want to have a natural casing hot dog that's beef and pork. And in the Detroit area, most of those come from Dearborn sausage. And, of course, up near Flint, where the Coneys are a little bit different, They come from Kogel.
Yes.
On top of that hot dog is the very important layer where people can improvise, and that's the chili. It must be a beanless chili.
So all meat, no
all
bean.
All meat, no beans. No beans on a Detroit Coney dog.
Okay.
No. And then on top of that, surprisingly, it gets a little bit less particular. It's a yellow salad mustard, and I have seen some Coney Islands have two different kinds of mustard, signifying that they don't really pay that much attention to which mustard they put on there. But it will not be Grey Poupon.
Okay.
big mistake to ask for Grey Poupon. And then onions. And some people put the onions on top of the mustard. Most people, I would say, put the mustard over the onions, which are white onions or Spanish onions. They should be minced.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a debate going on about whether they should be minced by hand or in a machine. The machine kind of mushes things up a little bit.
So you get that great crunch when you bite into it.
Oh, you do? Mm-hmm. And you get that snap when you bite that natural casing hot dog.
Yeah, no boiled hot dogs the way that we had them growing up as kids. We don't even want to
go
there.
No, it's not boiled hot dog. I have seen people who drop the hot dog into a deep fryer. You do not do that.
Was it created elsewhere and brought to Detroit, Joe, or where did it all come from?
Well, this is interesting. Think about what kind of food it is, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. It is a very simple working man's food. Nobody was there to pop a bottle of champagne or cut a ribbon when the first one was made. So we don't know where the first one was made. And there's a great body of evidence that says it happened almost simultaneously in a lot of places. a lot of places run by Greeks. We have Coney Islands dating back to about 1920 in downtown Detroit, of course, and in St. Petersburg, Florida, and Worcester, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, and Indiana. So all these places started making Coney Island hot dogs about the same time. And this was before places like these would have fries. So it was pretty much a Coney, a drink, chips, and you were out of there.
And when was this? What can we kind of pin a date to when Detroit got the Coney?
Well, this is controversial. The great Coney Island places in Detroit, American and Lafayette, have been there a long time. There's some discussion about when they opened. They'll claim a date as long ago as before 1920, but the Detroit City directories don't back that up. The Detroit City directories say that at those locations, other businesses were being done before 1920. Now, those two great places were founded by the Karros family. First one, then the other, and then actually, Cynthia, there was a third Karros-run Coney Island right next to the first two.
It's no really?
There. Now it's a Walter's Pipe Shop. But we used to—you didn't expand your business. You just bought the next one and started doing the same thing right there.
Nothing like a nice family feud to kind of get things mushrooming, right?
Well, actually, the family feud is what helped us become the number one Coney city in the world, I think.
How so?
Well, what happened was there was one split in the family, and so then American and Lafayette fell into different ownerships. They're competitive, and they were no longer—they are no longer owned by the same family. So American opens up, is very experimental. They'll have a, you know, they'll sell Coney dogs at the Detroit Zoo in Las Vegas. They'll ship them everywhere. Lafayette remains pretty traditional, kind of a one-stop shop right there. And then in around the time the Detroit population was moving to the suburbs, there was another split in the Karros family. This was actually what happened was Tony Karros started opening Coney Islands all around in these new shopping centers in the suburbs. And this carried the Coney Island tradition out to the suburbs, just as the freeways were carrying the population out to these new subdivisions.
And now we have, what, something like 500 in the Detroit area?
That's what Catherine and I estimate. The number changes every day because, of course, Coney Islands are opening and closing all the time. So we have taken drives just to count, just to do a Coney census along Gratiot Avenue and Michigan Avenue and up Woodward. And we come back with a count of something like about 30 to 50 Coneys on each of those roads. And then we have big chains, National Coney Island, Leo's Coney Island, Karros, Kirby's Coney Islands.
Yes,
sorry.
Kirby's, that's right.
Yeah, Kirby stands for Karros Brothers.
Okay.
So they're related to that original important family in Detroit.
And when I think of, you know, I grew up in Southeast Michigan. I grew up in Ferndale, and I've lived in Southeast Michigan my whole life. So when I think of a Coney restaurant, immediately I'm thinking, I can get in there, I can get a Coney dog, Greek salad, omelets, sandwiches of all kinds, soups. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had a nickel for every Greek salad I've eaten from what is now Leo's, but I go back to the 70s when I used to go to Southfield Coney Island on Southfield Road, and Pete and Joe would make me the Greek salad, the same kind that Leo's has today. Is that what we're talking about, Coney Island restaurants?
Well, when Catherine and I wrote Coney Detroit, we were debating, and we had some pretty knockdown, drag-out debates about this, what should be in the book. Mm. And one of the things we thought would be important would be, it would be nice if Coney was in the name, although I have to tell you, I have been to one restaurant that calls itself a Coney Island, and they don't even have any Coney Islands.
Huh.
They told me that they sell chicken, not Coney Island, but if you don't call your restaurant a Coney Island, people in Detroit won't know what it is. So, and then there are some great places that don't have, they sell great Coneys, but they don't have Coney in the name. But what we were looking for is places that sell mostly or rely on Coney Islands as a real mainstay, and they make pretty good ones. Now, we talked to Leo's, and they said in some of their restaurants up around Bloomfield Hills, they'll sell more salads than Coney Islands. But they still make a great Coney, so of course they're part of the tradition.
I have to ask, and so now I can finally hopefully have you solve a question that's been in my mind. So we've got Detroit at 632 miles and a 10-hour some car drive from Coney Island in Brooklyn, New York. How'd that Coney Island name become affixed to, you know, a Detroit food and a Detroit kind of restaurant?
Well, I'm going to give you a guess, and then I'm probably going to give you something that's a further mystery.
Okay.
So I don't know that I'll be that helpful. We've heard different stories about where the name came from. But the fact is, many of these Coney Islands popped up simultaneously in different places, all by Greek families. So our guess is, and there's so many debates about this, but our guess is that at this time, around 1900 to 1920, there was a big diaspora of people from Greece, many of whom came to the United States, came through Ellis Island, which is not Coney Island, but it's kind of in the neighborhood. And then the Greeks went out through the United States, the eastern part of the United States, to settle and start businesses. Hmm. So here I am. I might have a long name. I might be using a different kind of alphabet. I might be using a different kind of language. And it's hard to get a job. So people started their own jobs. They hired themselves. And they said, what should we do? Well, we can make food. Well, what do Americans like? Well, we saw them eating these hot dogs. Not this kind of hot dog, though. They saw hot dogs. Like you might think of a Nathan's at Coney Island in New York.
Right.
And what became different about Coney Island hot dogs is this topping, this meat topping. That was a change from what you see traditionally in New York. We think that sauce, which is the same sauce or a similar sauce to what they use, it's Skyline Chili in the Cincinnati area, also started by Greeks. That sauce has a Greek root. So we think that's a form of a Greek sauce, Americanized, put on a hot dog, and sold to people as a quick lunch.
Interesting. Like you said, a good working man's quick lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And there is something very special, especially if you're downtown and, you know, you're at the original at American or Lafayette. As you like to point out, it is truly the great equalizer. Everybody's there, and it doesn't matter what time, the stools will be full of people munching on those Coney dogs.
Oh, that's right. You'll have a college student sitting next to a Tiger fan from the suburbs sitting next to a cop.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's having the same thing, and they're all in that same Coney space.
Yeah. Now, it was interesting as I'm looking at your piece in Our Detroit, as you say, not every Coney is a Detroit Coney. So as we wander around Michigan, there are permutations of the Coney.
Oh, there certainly are. And the biggest permutation and the biggest controversy, I think, is the Flint and the Jackson-style Coney Islands. If you go to Flint, and I suggest you go to Flint and try Angelo's, which is the oldest surviving traditional place, and Starlight Coney Island, that's a great place, and Mega Coney Island, you'll get a Flint Coney Island, which will be Kogel hot dog, same kind of bun. The topping, they call it a topping, probably comes from Abbott Meats, and it's a drier, meatier topping than we have in Detroit, so of course that's good, right?
Mm.
The problem is that the Flint people can be kind of arrogant about their conies and say that, oh my gosh, a Detroit Coney Island, that stuff is pretty much just like gravy that you put on your conies. So I would try a Flint Coney Island if I had the chance. Now the real controversy is that over in Jackson, they have a very similar coney. It's attributed to a family called Todorov. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in history, the Todorov family started the story that they invented the Coney Island hot dog, which other people in Jackson who are making and selling Coney say that doesn't really track with what we believe. And actually, one newspaper columnist who was making this claim that the Coney Island was invented in Jackson, Michigan, around 1915, told me that just because you can't prove something doesn't make it false.
So feelings run strong.
Oh, my gosh.
And then as you get to Grand Rapids, as you point out, it gets a little more Chicago-y.
Oh, it does. It's kind of, you know, I kind of like pickles. But if you get over to Kalamazoo, where there's a great place, and over toward Chicago, you'll start to see little slivers of pickles that people want to put on the hot dogs in the Coney Islands. So, and that's reminiscent of the big pickle spear you get on a Chicago dog.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And you will not find pickles on a Detroit-style Coney Island. They don't have pickles.
Yeah.
Forget it. The one thing that you should never do this, is put ketchup on a Coney Island. If you ask for ketchup, some Coney Islands will throw you out. That's only for the fries.
Or if you just have a naked hot dog.
Well, I've seen a person order a plain Coney Island, which means a naked hot dog. That's a very disappointing thing to see.
We can talk Coneys all day. The book is Coney Detroit. You can also check out the current edition of Our Detroit Magazine, the food issue, and check out Joe Grimm's story, The Coney Challenge, American or Lafayette, Here's How to Decide Which Dog Cuts the Mustard Once and for All. Joe Grimm, always great talking with you. Now you've made us all starving.
I have to run out and get something.
Amen. We're with you. Joe, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The mass shooting in an Orlando nightclub that killed 49 people focused the nation's attention on the gay, lesbian, and transgender community. Those Orlando headlines may obscure the fact that transgender people face heavy, heavy challenges day in and day out. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs reports attacks against transgender individuals jumped 13% in 2014. And there's this. Nearly half, 41% of transgender individuals attempt suicide. And when compared to the general population, trans people are nearly four times more likely to have an annual income of under $10,000. A new West Michigan nonprofit is hoping to get trans youth past those barriers. The Grand Rapids Trans Foundation launched late last year, and here with us is the founder and director, Simon Kittock. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. And we welcome Misha Van Varenberg, who's the secretary of the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation. Hello, Misha.
Hi. Thank you, Cynthia.
So glad to have you both with us. Simon, what was your goal in founding the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation?
I think, like you mentioned, there's a lot of statistics that show us that the trans community face many challenges, heightened rates of discrimination, violence, unemployment. And I think that's across the board, across the country. And we see that here in Grand Rapids, too. I work for Grand Rapids Community College, and I'm the advisor for the LGBTQ organization here on campus. I see a lot of students that are struggling not only with financial issues, but with home issues, employment issues, healthcare issues. We really just wanted to kind of take one obstacle out of the way of these students who are dealing with so much already.
And that obstacle is cost.
Yeah. To a large extent, this comes down to a matter of resources and lack of resources. And we've seen that resources can really help someone get on top of their situation.
And we know the foundation's getting ready to award a scholarship to a low-income trans student in Kent County. How much and who was eligible?
This first year, we had one scholarship for $2,500 awarded to one individual. That individual, all they had to do or be in order to be applicable was to be a trans individual, and they also have to demonstrate financial need.
Misha, I want to get a sense for you. What role did education play in your transition?
Oh, I'd say it has made a tremendous difference. I am transgender. I'd consider myself post-transition at this point and began transitioning or realized I had to transition my senior year of college. And having a supportive school environment, even though that very much complicated my senior year, and now having a bachelor's degree in addition to having a supportive employer, it has made a significant difference. And having any education after a post-secondary degree can do a great deal to alleviate the disparity between transgender people and their cisgender peers in unemployment in that under 10,000 statistic you mentioned earlier. Mm. And so knowing that that was a possibility and that was our goal for the first year of the program for the Trans Foundation, that made it very attractive to me and I was eager to take part.
My understanding was when you transitioned, you had health insurance, but it was excluded.
That is correct, yes. And things are changing now where you get to see exactly how that's going to shake out and how insurance providers are going to interpret the most recent set of rulings. But the Affordable Care Act has made tremendous effort to make sure that transgender people can have not only the standard basic requirements that should be covered under all healthcare plans, but also the trans-specific care that so many of us need.
So the fact that you had your degree, didn't have a lot of debt, and that degree helped you get a job, helped make this possible for you in a way that might not have been the case had you not had that degree.
5 odd years ago, I was in a situation where I had to pay for most of my trans-specific medical care out of pocket. And I was able to do that without damaging my future prospects.
I was looking on the website for the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation, and I was struck by part of the mission statement. This is a quote. We're dedicated to removing obstacles that hold our trans community back. Trans folks shouldn't have to fight to survive. And that leads me to wonder, what would you say the environment is like in Grand Rapids for trans people, especially the young people trying to get themselves through school?
Grand Rapids is much like the rest of the country. Your poverty level has a great deal of influence in whether or not you have a good experience moving through the world. And this is true for all people, but it's particularly the case for transgender people. Your experience in Grand Rapids will depend on where you are in life and what resources you have access to. So for folks like me who are lucky enough to have their college education subsidized and have a supportive employer and a supportive family, I've had a very positive experience in Grand Rapids. Hopefully, and that's one of the goals of the foundation, to elevate everyone to that level.
Simon, you've said rights for trans people are 30 years behind the rest of the gay community. Why do you think this is?
As LGBT rights and the gay rights movement kind of came into its own, there was kind of a notable shift in the types of things the LGB community wanted. And I think something like gay marriage, people just loving who they want to love, is a very attractive idea and one that's very easy to sell to a largely straight country. Mm. Gender and gender identity is a much harder concept for people to kind of wrap their heads around. The LGB community has, to a large extent, pursued these low-hanging fruit, love, while using the trans community as a trading chip in some of these legislations to protect. The one that I'm thinking about specifically is ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which basically cut off transgender protections in order to obtain LGB protections. The trans community has often been pushed to the side, therefore just hasn't had the same resources, the same visibility as the rest of the community.
The most recent study showed that transgender people are 0.6% of the American population. That's a very small minority. While that might make it difficult for that to be a relatable issue, if folks may not know transgender people personally, I'd say for such a small minority, that makes it even more important that there be media exposure and public awareness of our needs and legal protections.
How are you hoping to see the work of the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation grow? I know you've just launched the foundation last December, giving out the first scholarship at the end of July. Where do you want to see this work go in the future, Simon?
Ideally, we would love to see our scholarship program expand from where it is. Currently, we only have one scholarship, and we would love to see it expand to really engage more individual lives in our community. In the future, we don't want to presume, our board is 3 members large, and we don't want to presume that we 3 people know what the entire Grand Rapids trans community needs or wants. So we are in the process of creating a survey that will poll the trans community here in Grand Rapids to really find out what are the most important issues that need to be addressed in our community specifically.
Simon Kiddock and Misha Van Varenberg are with the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation. You can find out more about the Grand Rapids Trans Foundation by going to their website, grtransfoundation.org, and you can also check them out on Facebook. Simon and Misha, thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That is the Phil Collins song You'll Be in My Heart from Disney's Tarzan. And yes, the rhythm section is a heartbeat. The heartbeat of a boy named Gabe, 17 years old. This is a lovely example of the work that music therapist Bridget Sova does every day at the Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids. Bridget records the heartbeats of patients and then sets it to music. Whether it's the heartbeat of a tiny baby heading home after being successfully cared for in the NICU, or the heartbeat of a child nearing the end of his battle with cancer. The recordings Bridget makes are treasured by parents and families. Bridget Sova is here with us now. Bridget, I just loved listening to these recordings. What an inventive way to give parents such a priceless gift. Where'd you get this idea?
Thank you so much. I actually got this idea when I was doing my internship at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. The idea came from a brilliant music therapist by the name of Brian Schreck, and I was learning under him right after he came up with this idea. And so the two of us got to work together on a lot of heartbeat recordings, and I was able to kind of master my craft by working with him, the person who came up with it.
And now you've brought this art of heartbeat recordings to Helen DeVos Children's Hospital. So there you are in West Michigan. And tell us, so how does this work? You record a heartbeat like we just heard Gabe's heartbeat. Tell us about how it works.
I have a stethoscope recorder, which a lot of people might think is something pretty high-tech, but it's actually just one of the disposable ones that we have in the hospital, and I chop off the tube about 2 inches from the chest piece of the stethoscope and stick a little lapel mic into the stethoscope, so the same thing that reporters use and clip onto their collar when they're talking. It's just something that's homemade. I can plug it right into my computer and then get that heartbeat recorded. It only takes about maybe 20 or 30 seconds. And then what I do is I go into a computer program and take out background noises so that you just hear that steady heartbeat. And after that, I can record the music by playing my guitar along to the heartbeat. And I always make sure that I am, you know, making my guitar playing fit the heartbeat so that each song is very unique to each patient.
And the parents or the patient picks a melody.
So I just ask for any song that's special to them and meaningful to them, and it could be anything from pop music to a lullaby. Everything works.
What has been the most offbeat song you've recorded so far?
That's a great question. The most offbeat song, and probably one of my favorite ones, was we did the Rocky theme song. So it was kind of like a fight song for this particular patient, and it was a lot of fun to turn that into a heartbeat recording.
Talk about the patients. Wide range. I mean, the initial one we heard from Gabe, you said, is 17 years old.
Yeah, I can record anybody's heartbeat, and sometimes we get the entire family's heartbeat. But this has been done with little babies who maybe they've had heart surgery, and it's kind of exciting to hear their steady beating, working heart after their heart surgery. I've also done it with older patients. Sometimes we get the whole family involved, so we record mom's heartbeat and dad's heartbeat, and we put it all together on one track so that all the hearts are beating together, and that's always a really fun experience.
You once recorded, Bridget, the heartbeat of a 10-year-old boy whose cancer had progressed, and he chose Best Day of My Life by American Authors. Tell us more about that recording and why he chose that song.
This was actually during my internship, and it was the first heartbeat recording that I ever did, so it's really stuck with me. This was a 10-year-old boy, like you said, who had a very progressed stage of cancer. And when I came to him with this idea, we actually had talked about the fact his cancer was getting worse, his body was starting to fail. And so for him, this was something that he could be involved in a way for him to leave a legacy for his family. And so we decided to come up with a heartbeat recording, and we called it his theme song. And so to make it a little bit more fun, and we worked on choosing a song together, and he chose Best Day of My Life. And what he said about the song was that it made him feel energized, it made him excited. And those were feelings that he didn't get very often during his long and very difficult stay in the hospital. And so I think that this song for him was kind of an escape from all of the uncomfortable things of the hospital. And so what we did was we recorded his heartbeat. I added the music, and he added a little introduction to the song that was very sweet, where he told his family and any listener why he chose the song and why it was his theme song.
We're going to take a listen to another sample of your work. Tell us first a little about, this is little Adeline's heartbeat set to You Are My Sunshine. What can you tell us about her?
Adeline's family was very dear to my heart when they were here in the hospital. We did a lot of music therapy with them that was different from the heartbeat recordings. So I did some lullabies with them. I helped her when she was learning how to feed from a bottle. She was a little NICU baby by using music. When I found out that she was going to have heart surgery, I definitely wanted to do a heartbeat recording for them. We were able to record Adeline's heartbeat and then put it to music and listen to her beautiful working, amazing heart that had just been fixed and was working so great. And You Are My Sunshine was the song that we chose because it was one of the songs that I used to sing to her a lot when she was in the NICU, and it always brought a smile to her mom's face to listen to that song and to see Adeline respond so well to it. This one was a really special recording as well.
I'm speaking with Bridget Sova, who's a music therapist at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids. And as part of her work, Bridget records heartbeat recordings, patients' heartbeats set to songs. And so some of these are like Adeline's celebration recordings. Others are commemorative recordings. What do you hear from parents and families once you put that recording in their hands?
You know, it's always different depending on the different families and the different personalities of the families. Sometimes I'll hear they listen to it every day and they put it on their phone and it's something that brings them joy or it's something that brings back a happy memory for them. And some families will tell me that they haven't had a chance to listen to it yet just because they haven't felt like they're ready for that yet. And they're thankful that they have it, and it's comforting for them to know that it's there and that they can listen to it any time, but they just aren't ready yet.
What got you into music therapy in the first place?
I actually got into music therapy after hearing about it for the first time when I was a senior in high school. I had just had an experience where I was visiting my grandma, who had dementia and also had just experienced painful surgery, and the only thing that really helped her was singing. That experience was so interesting to me, and then hearing about the field of music therapy right after that, I knew that this was something that I was interested in. It's a way for me to combine my love of music and my love of helping people together. And so it ended up being perfect for me. And as soon as I heard about it, I never really looked back.
Are you aware, Bridget, of anyone else offering these heartbeat recordings at other hospitals? It seems like these would be treasured by family members no matter what the age of the patient.
You know, actually the word is starting to spread around, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so excited that I'm getting the opportunity to speak with you today, because every time a music therapist hears about this, a lot of times they will reach out to me or they'll reach out to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, my supervisor Brian there, and we'll be able to share how to do this, how to make the stethoscope recorder, how to get all the background noises out, and how to add your own music to it. So I think that this is something that Brian really wants to share with everyone and wants to get the word out there and wants everyone to be able to do, because it is so precious and something that can be so cherished forever. So we're hoping that more and more hospitals will do this. I, you know, get emails all the time and talk to people on the phone all the time about it. So there are hospitals that are starting to do this other than the two of mine and also Cincinnati.
Bridget Sova does heartbeat recordings as part of her work as a music therapist at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids. Bridget, thank you so much for sharing your work with us. These are beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk.
Today's State Ed was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.